Okay, welcome everyone to Awakening Together's monthly satsang. This month's guest is Joan Tollefson. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you.
And let me tell y'all a little bit about Joan. Joan points to the simplicity of what is, this unbound, awaring presence, and this present happening here now, before the mind interprets, labels, or tells stories about it. She is interested in seeing through the imaginary problems and stories of deficiency and lack that we take to be real, and waking up to the aliveness of this moment exactly as it is. Her bare bones approach is open, direct, immediate, and down to earth. She invites a meditative exploration that is non-methodical and awareness-based, encouraging people to look and listen for themselves and to question all secondhand ideas and formulations. What can we know for sure beyond all doubt? What are we most deeply referring to when we use the word I? Are we limited to or encapsulated inside the body? Is there an actual boundary between inside and outside? How do apparent choices and decisions actually happen? These are the kind of questions Joan invites people to explore. She encourages people not to land on one side of any dualistic conceptual divide, but to remain in the open wonder of groundlessness and not knowing. Joan's main teacher was Tony Packer, a former Zen teacher who left that tradition behind to work in a simpler and more open way. Joan spent time with many other teachers as well, exploring Buddhism, Advaita, and other forms of non-duality, but she does not identify with any particular tradition. Joan is the author of Bare Bones Meditation, Waking Up from the Story of My Life, Awaken the Heartland, The Ecstasy of What Is, Painting the Sidewalk with Water, Talks and Dialogues about Non-Duality and Nothing to Grasp. She is at work now on a book that explores growing old, dying, and finding happiness right where you are. Joan has lived in Northern California, rural New York State, and Chicago. She currently resides in Southern Oregon. I love that. I downloaded a sample of the Painting the Sidewalk with Water. I've just begun it, but I really love it. I love the title. So, Joan, I'm not sure how I came across your material on the internet, but it just seemed like it was an immediate fit for our group, Awakening Together. And I particularly like the fact that you are really leading people to a direct experience as opposed to being tied to any teachings. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, direct experience is the only thing that we really have that's actual. And our human habit seems to be to go very much into conceptualization and thought. And in fact, we do that so much and so ubiquitously that we even lose sight of the fact that we're doing it. So we're talking, I mean, we have concepts, like even a concept like my body. If you really look at it, what is my body? It's a visual image, or it's from the, you know, if I close my eyes, it's vibrating sensations and pulsating energy. It's an ever-changing process, never the same from one instant to the next. And yet when we have a label like my body, it seems like it's this solid, substantial thing. And so even something as sort of innocent as my body, if you really look at it, the concept, the word, creates a solidity in the imagination that isn't really here. And so one of the reasons that we suffer is that we habitually, as someone famously said, we mistake the map for the territory. And in spirituality, we spend a lot of time, you know, reading multiple different menus and looking at many different maps and trying to compare them to each other and figure out which is the right map and trying to get the right. It's like we're trying to understand the nature of reality or something. And, you know, in fact, the truth is we really don't know what this is. And yet we know it intimately. It's our most direct, intimate, obvious experiencing here now. Just being here and present experiencing is obvious. We don't have to make an effort to be aware or to experience. It's just happening. But as soon as we start trying to think and talk about what it is, then we're in the realm of maps, conceptual maps. And those have their usefulness. It's not that we're going to get rid of that or discard them, but the juice, the aliveness, is in the actuality itself. And so I find that it's just really helpful to just be in this moment, just be here, just listening to the traffic or the birds and feeling the sensations in the body, feeling the breathing, not as some heavy-handed practice, but just out of interest and love for this, just a natural exploration, just allowing the attention to go where it wants to go and just feeling the energy, feeling the vibrations, feeling the pulsations, feeling this happening, just seeing the colors and shapes, hearing the sounds, without labeling it and telling a story about it and trying to understand it. I mean, the labels may pop up. You know, the label, oh, that's an airplane flying overhead, might pop up, which is not a problem. But just letting that sort of pass through and just the sound itself, you know, the actual sound is not, there's no separation between me and the airplane sound if I don't talk about it and think about it. The actual is just immediate. It's just right here. And when we sort of tune in to this, just being here, to the bare happening of this moment. Well, first of all, you might notice that we don't have any problems here. We might still have physical pain or something, but we it takes thought to conjure up all our problems. And there's really no me here unless we start thinking. You know, that thought has to pop up like, am I doing this right? And as soon as that thought pops up, it immediately creates the mirage of the me who might be doing this wrong and has to do it right because hopefully I want to get somewhere and get something out of this, which is our habitual way of approaching things. And just to see all that, not to try to get rid of it, but just to see all that and then notice that at the same time, there's just the and the whoosh, 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 and the sounds of the rain and the colors and shapes and just the feeling of breathing, the tingling in the hands or the feet, just the bare happening of this moment. And then thought might pop up again and say, well, now is this what Nisargadatta was talking about? And then we're off again, you know, trying to think about it, trying to figure it out. And that's fun sometimes, but it generates a lot of confusion and it feeds into the story, our sort of bottom line story of lack and deficiency, you know, that there's me here and that I'm separate from the universe and that I'm in danger and I'm vulnerable and I have to figure out how this all works and I have to get the right answer and I have to get the right experience and I probably shouldn't be having the experience I'm having. I should be having some other experience that's more open or spacious or peaceful or calm or something, and then I'll be okay. Instead of just what's here right now? What is this?
This is wonderful. It's wonderful information, because it's funny, because even these, even what you're seeing can be turned into a concept, because the thinking mind or the ego or the personal self, I mean, whatever you want to call it, wants to claim, oh, now I understand.
Right.
Right. So even that gets conceptualized.
Right. I've got it, you know, yeah. And, oh, this is it. And, but you know, there, it is all, whatever it is, this is, it's not really an it, but this is always changing. It's never the same. It, you know, as they say, we never can step into the same river twice. Mm-hmm. And the stepper is never the same from one instant to the next. It's, you know, everything is changing. So, you know, we're always looking for sort of a final package, a final answer that we can grab onto, like everything is consciousness or whatever it is, you know, some sort of final package. But then we look at, what do we even mean by consciousness? I mean, on the one hand, it's our most immediate experience, you know, being conscious. But what is it exactly, you know? You know, it's like we can't really get hold of things in the way that the mind kind of wants to.
And yet we keep trying, and we think unless we've got a hold of it, we haven't got anything.
Right, right. And you know, these words like consciousness and awareness and all this, they're useful. They point to a certain sort of aspect of reality and help us to notice it, you know, maybe. But then we get kind of fixated on them, and we try to make them into something, and we try to sort of formulate this final package, this answer. And then we compare, you know, Rupert Spira to Nisargadatta to Tony Packer to Joan Tollefson or whatever. And we, you know, we get confused, and we feel like we want to figure out who's right, and we want to get it right and all of that.
And we want to get somewhere.
And we want to get somewhere. Yeah, we want to be on the winning team. We want to get the right answer so that we'll be okay, so that basically so that we'll survive, so that we'll triumph, so that, you know, we don't want to be a loser. We don't want to, you know.
Choose wrongly. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you mentioned so that we'll survive. But what I think that I have heard you say is that, and I think that what we're learning in Awakening Together is that there's really no I or continuous entity that exists. So how can it continue to survive?
Right. It's like our whole fear of death is really, you know, I often compare it to the fear people used to have of if they sailed out into the ocean, they'd fall off the edge of the earth. You know, it was a very real fear, but it was based on a complete misunderstanding of the earth. You know, that they thought you could fall off because the earth was a flat plane.
Right.
And now, you know, we have this idea that there's this self, and, you know, there's something here that we call Joan or Jacqueline. There's, you know, that's undeniable. And it has a certain flavor, a certain personality, a certain, you know, it's, but, and there's a certain sense of location and identity as a body mind that appears intermittently as needed, you know, so that we know how to respond to our name, and we know how to cut a carrot without cutting off our fingers, and we know, you know, how to put the food in our mouth and not the other person's mouth. And, you know, so that's a functional sense of, you know, location and embodiment that we have that is not here all the, it sort of comes as it's needed. It's an intermittent. So there's that. We're not denying the person in that sense. But when we really look at the person, I mean, as I said before, when we look at the body, we find nothing but continuous change. And, you know, you look at nature, something dies, it gets reabsorbed into the earth, eaten by other things. It, you know, the whole body gets recycled, as it were. And this, what's fictional about the me is this, you know, this kind of idea we have that there's this entity in here who's at the control panel, as it were, thinking my thoughts, authoring my thoughts, making my decisions, making my choices, living my life. And when we look for that me, we don't find anything. I mean, it's just a thought, or a train of thought. It's just an idea or a mental image or, you know, the subject of a grammatical sentence, the grammatical subject of a sentence.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just, we sort of assume it's in there, but it's, we can't really find it. One neuroscientist called the sense of self and agency, he said they are neurological sensations, which I think is a very good description. They're just kind of idea, thought, sensations we have. And yet when we really look closely, we can't find them. So what is it that dies? I mean, when someone we love dies, we can't deny that there's something that was there that's not there anymore, right, that we miss. I mean, to deny that would be, I think, crazy.
Yeah.
but what is actually, the more we sort of look into what is it that's gone, what is it that was here in the first place, we don't, you know, that person was changing from moment to moment. They weren't one solid thing. And there were many moments when they weren't there in front of us. You know, what's different now, other than the story that I'll never see them again, you know? And so it's like, we don't want to deny loss or grief or anything, but and then when I die, you know, it's like our fear of that, I think, comes from the idea that I'm still going to be here knowing that I've died. You know, it's like I'm going to be buried alive trying to get the television back on so I can see what's next in the story of my life, and not being able to get the TV on. And, you know, but every night in deep sleep, this whole movie vanishes. The one who cares about it vanishes. The one who's concerned about all this vanishes. The one who's trying to figure it all out vanishes. There's no fear of dying. There's no, in deep sleep, we're not worried about whether we're going to wake up again. It's just, if it's all of that is not there anymore. So, you know, what are the fear is about is just based on a mistake, like falling off the edge of the flat earth.
An incorrect starting point. Well, let me ask you first, you talked about these, how you would refer to this unit. I know you probably wouldn't because it doesn't really exist, but you talked about these, something appearing intermittently.
Uh-huh.
And I took it to mean what, you know, this unit or this, you know, this personality, this character, whatever's going on, appearing intermittently, right?
Well, I actually meant, you know, I think I was saying the functional sense of being identified and located as a particular body mind
appears intermittently
as needed. You know, like we know how to cut the carrot and how to differentiate between the carrot and our finger.
Right.
Or we know that you know whose name to answer to and that sort of thing. So that's functional, but it's, you know, that sense of me isn't there all the time. Like, you know, if you're just washing the dishes or driving the car or doing any number of ordinary things, gardening or whatever, you know, much of it, and we don't even notice this because it's so ordinary, but much of the time we're just, you know, we're just washing the dishes or driving along, you know, and then there's no me in the picture until a thought pops up like, oh my God, you know, why did I do that? Or, what if this happens to me? Or, am I doing this right? Or something like that. And then all of a sudden there seems to be a me.
Wouldn't you say that most of the population has those I thoughts going on all the time?
Well,
I don't know.
I doubt that they're going on all the time. Although people may not be noticing the times when they're not there. But, you know, I think they're not going on all the time, I would suspect. I mean, even when we do something like watch a TV show, I mean, one of the reasons we like to watch movies and TV shows is that our thought of I just, you know, we stop thinking about me.
Yes, that's true.
I kind of disappear, and there's this other story happening, and I'm caught up in that, and, you know, the attention is caught up in that, and enjoying that. And it's a relief. You know, my problems disappear for the hour that I'm watching this show or something. So I think everybody in some way has the experience of, you know, no self gets turned into this sort of mystified thing like, oh, God, I've got to find no self, or I've got to experience no self or something. But I think no self is actually a really common experience that everybody is having. A lot of the time, they're just not noticing it. And what comes and goes is the thought, sense, story of me, and the functional sense that we need of, you know, being me, that allows me to, you know, differentiate between me and the bus so I can get on the bus. I mean, some people actually, like Oliver Sacks, writes books about, you know, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. You know, he was a neurologist or a neuroscientist or whatever, and he wrote books about all kinds of neurological and brain injuries. And, you know, people can actually lose that ability to functionally locate, and it's it causes problems. So enlightenment, or whatever these words are, and they're all sort of like, I wish we didn't have them, but, you know, but is not pointing to something grandiose experience that nobody has had. It's pointing to our most ordinary reality that we're just overlooking a lot of the time.
So is it like I don't get enlightened once and for all, right?
Not in my book. Because to me, that's a complete oxymoron that there's an enlightened person who's permanently enlightened. That presumes that there's some stable person here, unchanging, and some stable state called enlightenment that's unchanging, and time, you know, permanence is like, so in that model, it's sort of like infinite time. When, as I see it, the only real infinity or eternity is now. Yeah. And so, you know, enlightenment and awakening and liberation and all these different words that get used in different ways by different people. But, and you know, some people do have dramatic experiences. I mean, Eckhart Tolle, for example, apparently one night had a very sudden, dramatic, seemingly more or less permanent shift from being completely caught up in the story of his life and totally depressed to being basically, just in a state of open, aware presence most of the time. That's, I think, a very rare occurrence. It does seem to happen sometimes. For most of us, it's a much more gradual unfolding. And it doesn't really matter how it happens. But I think those enlightenment stories have unfortunately caused a lot of people a lot of suffering because people are seeking that, and comparing their, you know, their experience to what this other person has described. And then, am I there yet? No, I think I'm not. And maybe if I read I Am That one more time, I might be. And, it doesn't really matter whether it's a sudden event, which it rarely is, or if it's gradual. It always boils down to right now, and Eckhart Tolle would say as much. It boils down to right now. And awakeness really just points to the natural state, to what's all, you know, what's already here. What comes and goes, really, is the illusion, the thought, the confusion, the mix-up. The story, you know, because there just is this present happening and this awareness here. And then all of a sudden there's the thought of, oh, my God, I've ruined my whole life. You know, I should have gone to law school. Oh, what, you know, and suddenly I seem to be me, and I seem to be all shrunk down to this little encapsulated self. And I seem to have taken a wrong turn, and I've ruined my life. And that feels really depressing. And now all of a sudden, you know, the the whole body sort of hums along with neurochemistry. And so I feel queasy in my stomach now. And that seems to confirm the story that I really messed it up. And next thing I know, I'm feeling really sad and depressed and anxious. And that's our suffering. But that's actually intermittent. It sweeps through. And at the same time that that's going on, there's present experiencing. I mean, that is our present experiencing or part of it at that moment. But there's also still the traffic sounds and the bird cheeps and the breathing. And it's just that the attention has gone to the story and to the sense of being this little shrunken down, encapsulated fragment who has ruined its life, which is an absurd idea. I mean, how could you ruin your life? I mean, your life is just your life, you know, and you can say, oh, I should have gone to law school. And instead I went and ripped off a 7-Eleven and ended up in jail. So I ruined my life. But, you know, if you ripped off a 7-Eleven and you're in jail, that's your life. You know, why is it ruined? It's just, that's just kind of, and those are just the outer circumstances. You know, what's actually going on is really fundamentally the same, we could say, whether you're sitting in jail or at a luxury spa or on a silent retreat. You know, there's just present experiencing, which the texture of which is always different and ever changing. But I mean, the fact of just present experiencing and being here now, being aware, is just the here now-ness of it, the here now. It's always now. We're always here in this presentness. And that's the same no matter what's appearing here, whether it's a prison cell or a luxury spa or a silent retreat or a busy office.
Well, and we're always here. We're in reality, we are always here now. But what we do is we project ourselves into the future. Well, not like that could really happen, but that's where our suffering seems to come from, is the fact that we project this imaginary, like you said, encapsulated fragment of, you know, this image of who we think we are, either into the past and have our regrets or whatever, or into the future and project our fears onto that. What if this and that happens?
Right.
We're still going to be okay.
And all of that happens now. I mean, that's all happening in the now. You know, the actual past, when it was happening now. And what we're referring to now is a memory, which, as we know, memory is very unreliable and fluid and alters itself as it goes along. So we're not really in the past. We're here now, involved in some memory story, or the future isn't here yet. When it is here, it will be here now.
Right.
And no matter how accurate our imaginations and predictions of the future are, they're never 100% accurate. I mean, no vacation ever goes exactly the way we plan it,
right.
Et cetera. So we're just, when we're thinking about the future, we're thinking about an imagination. And we have to do that. I mean, it's, of course, if you're planning a vacation or a trip or something, or organizing this interview or whatever, you have to think about the future and make plans. But when all of that planning is happening now, and when the vacation or the interview or whatever happens, it's happening now, and it's not going to be the way it was imagined.
Right, because you couldn't possibly know what's going to happen.
Yeah, you can't.
Well, it's is this what Jesus was talking about when he said being in the world but not of it?
Well, I don't know what Jesus was talking about, but possibly, yeah, that. I mean, I would hear that as being, you know, that, yeah, relatively speaking, we seem to be in this world. This world is happening, you know, when we can't ignore that. I mean, we can't ignore. I mean, we have to go to shop for groceries and
excuse me, I'm sorry. I should.
Huh?
Go ahead.
Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. It's just, you know, it's the happening. It's just a raw happening. And then the mind can come in and say, oh, that was a distraction. That was an interruption. That shouldn't have happened. I should have turned the phone off. But it was just what it was. You know, it was just ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And then those thoughts flitting through. And so, we can't ignore the world. We can't ignore the phone and the computer and the grocery store and what's happening in the world and everything else. But at the same time, we can begin to see how ephemeral it all is and how our ideas of it are just ideas. They're just maps. They're, you know, everything. We have our ideas about what's going on, and other people have really different ideas.
Well, tell me why I want to get off the map and into reality.
Well, I mean, it's not that we want to get rid of maps. I mean, mapping is something that reality is doing, you could say. It's part of this living process, and it has its functional utility. But when we don't recognize the difference between the map and the territory, when we mistake the map for the territory, that's when we get into confusion and suffering. So, you know, I can have an idea about something. I mean, I can think, well, climate change is a serious problem. And maybe that moves me to do something about it or to talk about it or whatever. There are other people who think it's not a serious problem, that it's not even happening. And the more I look at the reality, the more I find how we can't really pin it down. We can't really grasp it.
In terms of saying whether or not climate change is something that's actually happening.
Anything. Uh-huh. Anything. I mean, is this interview actually happening? It's like, of course, you know, relatively speaking, it is, and we think it is, and it's we can't deny that something's going on here.
Right.
But what is it exactly? You know, we have our way of describing it. Well, we're on Skype, and we're doing this interview for this, you know, Awakening Together, and I'm Joan, and you're Jacqueline, and I'm in one location, and you're in another, and we're on our computers, and that's all, you know, relatively true and accurate as far as it goes. But the more we sort of look into any of these things, the less solid they seem, you know, like, what is Joan? What is Jacqueline? You know, the more closely you look at it, the more it sort of disintegrates or seems to be the whole everything. You can't find it. And the same is true with everything.
I have been getting the sense lately that, at least when I'm not thinking about myself in a very solid manner, that it seems to me the difference is in seeing me appearing in a world as opposed to a world appearing within me.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have the story that we've learned that I am born into the world, that the world was here before I was born. It will be here after I die. I have been born into it. I'm separate from it. It's out there. Right. And then in our direct experience, we can see that what we're calling the world, and again, the world is an abstraction. It's a map, like the body. You know, the world is like an infinity of what? Vibrations, energies, sensations, events, ever-changing, swirling, whirling, vibrating events. You know, what is the world? But anyway, whatever that is, all of that appears in me. It appears in this awareness that I am. It appears in this here-now-ness that I am. It, as does my body, as does the story of Joan, as does Jacqueline, as does my computer. Everything that I, you know, can think about or perceive or sense or imagine is appearing here in this here-ness, this now-ness, this awareness, which I can't find any boundary to it, any place where it begins or ends, any, you know. And then in Advaita, we kind of conceptualize that, or in Buddhism a bit too, some strands of Buddhism, as, you know, okay, everything is consciousness. There's only consciousness. It's all, there is nothing out, there is no world. And as I see it, we don't really know. We can't really know all these things. Like, I don't know what, you know, what this is, you know, this is what I'm calling my desk. I don't really know what, you know, it's wood, but, and science says, oh, there's atoms and molecules and subatomic particles, and they keep finding new things that are there or not there, and it's mostly empty space. And then, you know, Advaita says it's all consciousness, and sure enough, it's an experience in consciousness. In that sense, it's consciousness, you know. I don't ever experience anything outside of consciousness or awareness. But what is this? I don't know, really. You know, and I don't really need to know. I mean, relatively speaking, in daily life, I need to know that it's my desk, and that's functional. And it helps to know that it's wood in a relative sense, so I don't set it on fire or whatever. But beyond that, I don't really need to know. You know, again, it's sort of I see that as the thinking mind, again, looking for some sort of final package that we can wrap everything neatly up in. It's all this. This is how it all works. And yet... my actual experience is that it doesn't work that way. It doesn't stay the same. It does, you know, one moment I can be experiencing this sort of feeling of just, you know, the awareness that isn't even perceivable or conceivable, in which everything is happening, and I can be kind of sensing into that and feeling that. And then another moment I'm feeling like Joan, and I'm, you know, upset because something has just happened that was upsetting to me, and I'm, you know, irritated. And then another moment I can be just listening to the meow of the airplane or the cheep, cheep, cheep of the bird. And it doesn't all kind of seem to be some neat package that's all, you know, except in the sense that it's all, I mean, the closest I can come is just to say that it's here now, that it's present experiencing, that it's the knowingness that I am here or whatever. But even that, I mean, every night in deep sleep, that all turns off. And that's not a terrifying thing. It's like, we look forward to that. It's a huge relief. The whole show just vanishes. What's left? Well, whatever's left is not an experience or a concept or anything we can perceive. And yet it doesn't feel scary. It doesn't feel like, you know, oh, I've fallen into the void of nothingness or something. You know? It feels like going home. And then the movie comes back on, night dreams, waking life, whatever. So I don't find a sort of final package in there somewhere, you know, or a finish line or any of that. You know, we're always looking for finish line or a resolution.
Yeah.
But we don't we don't really need that until it's only, you know, when you're just being here, enjoying the sensations and the energies of the moment, you don't really, or washing the dishes or driving the car or whatever, you don't, or talking or whatever, you don't really need any of that. It's only when thought pops up and says, and it always has the me at the center of it, you know, oh my God, you know, I need to really understand this. I need to be sure I'm having the right final experience and the right final understanding. And I'm not sure oh God, maybe I don't. And quick, let's look at I Am That again, or let's watch another YouTube of Rupert and see if I can get it, you know, or whatever we do, you know. And there's nothing wrong with watching YouTubes or reading I Am That. I mean, I Am That is a wonderful book. And so it's not like I'm saying we shouldn't be doing those things, but we can begin to become sensitive to what's going on when we are doing them. Sometimes when we're doing them, it really feels like it's opening something up, you know, that it's opening something up for us. And other times you can really feel that it's sort of coming from this place of desperation and lack and seeking and tightness. And yet there's some kind of fear that if I turn it off, if I don't read, if I don't look at it, oh God, you know, what's then? But when we actually risk that and just put it all down for a moment and just be here, not in any formal way, not, okay, now I'm going to meditate, but just, I'm just sitting, just being here. It's not scary. It's not, in fact, it's quite enjoyable. And then, you know, we could get the idea, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this all the time. And then that becomes another burden.
I'm supposed to be being present all the time.
You mean? Yeah, so I'm supposed to be, you know, just paying attention to sensations and stuff like that all the time and not reading and not thinking. And that, of course, doesn't work. And it's not the point. I mean, it's fine to watch movies and read books and watch YouTubes and all of that. There's nothing, it's all part of this whole dance, really.
So we don't want to ritualize it.
Yeah, you know, we get into these ideas like, this is the right thing to be doing, and this will save me if I do this. If I just pay attention to sensations all the time, then that will save me. You know, that's not how it works. Because that's a thought again, that's that me in the center again thinking, you know, I'm not there now, but I want to get there, and maybe if I do this, that will work.
So, right. Again, it's that mental projection of some sense of self into some other.
Right. Like, this isn't it, but someday I hope to get there. And you know, spirituality feeds into that because we have all these sort of ideas of what we're supposed to be experiencing if we're awake. Like, we should be calm. We should feel peaceful and loving. We should be happy. And so if we happen to feel angry or depressed or sad or anxious or whatever, then we think, oh, I must not be doing it right. This is, you know, I've fallen from grace, whatever.
Right.
But these are just, I like to call them just weather events. You know, it's like you look outside, it's not always sunny and clear. You know, there are clouds and storms and catastrophic events that happen. And it's the same way with the inner weather. And each of us has different inner weather patterns for the same kind of, just the way different cities have different weather patterns. You know, Seattle is not the same as Miami. And it would be stupid if Seattle was trying to be like Miami, I mean, or something. You know, it would be like, you know, they're just different weather patterns. And so some humans, some body minds have more tendency towards anxiety or more tendency towards depression or more tendency towards, you know, obsessive thinking or whatever, for who knows what 10 million reasons, neurochemistry, genetics, you know, who knows. And it's all, you know, it's none of it is really a problem in the way we think it is. You know, it's like we keep thinking we have a big problem. You know, and we kind of carry it around from one spiritual teacher to the next, like, here's my problem. Can you fix it? Whatever we think it is, like, oh, God, my mind is still so active, or, you know, oh, I still get angry all the time or whatever. But what's the problem, really?
Well, it seems to me that it's caught up with, it's a necessary result of believing in this idea of good or bad. You know, I'm being a good person, or I'm being a good student, or I'm doing an awakening good, or I'm doing it all bad. You know, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad student, I'm not doing it correctly. And it seems like it gets at the very heart of this idea of duality and non-duality, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because nothing is all, you know, nothing is really that way. Like, the man, you know, this whole, whatever this is, it does show up in apparent polarities. And if it didn't, it wouldn't show up at all. You know, if everything was black, there would be nothing. If everything was white, there would be nothing. You know, it's like, it shows up in contrasts and polarities. That's how it works. But we have this sort of idea that the polarities could actually be pulled apart, that they're actual things. They're not actual things. It's like, you know, the ceiling is up from the perspective of the floor, but from the perspective of outer space, the ceiling is down. Right. You know, so it's like the ceiling isn't really up or down. It's just, you know, that's all relative to where you're looking at it from. So, you know, these polarities are not absolutes in the way that we think they are. And then we can't pull them apart the way, we can't pull good and evil apart. We can't have just good or just happiness or just peace or something. You know, it's like, it doesn't work that way. They somehow go together like the old Zen koan, you know, sickness and medicine. I forget what the wording is, sickness and medicine. Well, anyway, they go together. They create each other. They work together. You know, life is like that. You know, and it's like the things that we often would call unfortunate things are often things that wake us up and end up being great blessings. The things that we would think of as, oh, this is really good fortune, can often bring a lot of suffering. Same is true with world events. You know, when you look at some of the terrible things that have happened, some beautiful things have come out of it. And, you know, it doesn't seem like the world stays in any one way. You know, there are empires rise and fall. Good leaders and bad leaders, so-called, come and go. And nobody is all good or all bad. I mean, if you take up meditation and look into your own mind, you know, you realize that you have Hitler and Buddha and Jesus and everybody in there.
Within you know, your own mind.
Yeah, within your own self, within your own mind. Yeah, you're not, you know, none of us is all good or all bad. And so, relatively we can say, you know, that, you know, if I back the car out and back into the fence post, that's a mistake. And I naturally want to correct that the next time I back out. You know, that's all relatively functional. But if I add on to that a whole story of, oh, I'm a terrible driver. Oh, I've ruined, you know, I shouldn't have backed into, oh, how could I have done that? woe is me. I know so-and-so wouldn't have done that. And then that's just suffering. Because the reality is we did back into the fence post. And it was just, in a sense, just a happening, just another happening. And to call it good or bad or a mistake or whatever is kind of extra.
Well, and this word keeps coming into my mind. I don't, it's not the best one, but here it is. So the trick is to really just allow everything to be the way it is without making up any stories about it, is what I hear you saying.
Well, exactly. Because,
well, tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, first of all, there's no one sort of here that can do all that. Stories occur.
Okay. And then what do I do? I mean, then what happens?
I mean, and first of all, everything is already allowed to be the way it is. I mean, we can notice that. It's already allowed to be the way it is, obviously, because it is the way it is.
Right.
The mind, you know, a thought can pop up and say that shouldn't have happened. But that thought is also allowed to be here. It's here. Everything is allowed to be as it is already. And we have the illusion that we're kind of in control and we're making choices and, you know, we have to figure out the right thing to do. So it's kind of like, oh, I get it. I just allow everything to be as it is and don't tell any stories. But first of all, there's no one to do that. You know, it's like everything is as it is. And that seems to include stories. I mean, stories are part of what this happening is. And stories can be wonderful. I mean, I love movies and novels and theater. And I mean, lots of stories are enlightening. They wake us up. They're transformative. They're beautiful. Or they're entertaining. They're fun. You know, and then that's different from there are other stories like I've ruined my whole life that are suffering. So we can notice whether a story is enjoyable and entertaining and awake and enlightening, you know, or whether it's a form of suffering. But it doesn't seem like we really get to choose. I mean, the stories just pop up, like the thought I've ruined my whole life just pops up. It can be seen for what it is, but we can't even really choose to do that. It just is or isn't seen.
Well, I appreciate that. I have a couple. I do have some follow-up questions.
Okay.
I had a follow-up question about practice and the value of practice and what practice might look like. I made a note here about really being in the I don't know, just allowing yourself to be in the I don't know-ness. And really what your answer to my last question about, you know, no, you don't allow anything to be everything to be what it is because it's already that way. It doesn't require my consent. It's just, you know, there's a way of being in the world that's not helpful. You know, I this, I that, only me, I, you know, I mean, you know, at odds with everything and, you know, I wish it was raining instead of sunny or so there's a way of not being in the world that we know, you know, that's not helpful.
Well, it's not helpful from our perspective.
Okay.
You know, again, we don't know how it all works because oftentimes when there's suffering, that's when we wake up. You know, again, medicine and sickness go together. When there's suffering, that's when we wake up. Or we don't know, maybe climate change and wiping out the human species is the best thing that can happen and is making the way a way for something whole new thing to happen. You know, we just, if we were the dinosaurs, we might think, oh, my God, we're going extinct. This is terrible. But, you know, so we don't know. It's from our perspective that it seems like, and we can certainly notice that certain things do seem to bring suffering and confusion and, you know, and that's helpful to see that.
And we can clue you in those things.
Well, good luck. I mean, we can quit when we can quit, you know, it's sort of like, and then we give, and when it works, then we, it feeds the illusion that we're making the choice ourselves, that we're some independent chooser here. Right. It's sort of like often compared to the, like we're a wave on the ocean and we have the illusion that we could go off in a different direction from the one the ocean is moving in.
Yeah. Well, and I heard you describe it. I think it was in your interview with Rick Archer. We think of ourselves as like paddling a boat down the stream of life when we are actually just that stream.
Or the stream. Everything is stream. Yeah. We have the illusion that we're sort of a cork in the stream or something. And that, or that we're paddling, that we're actually steering and in control. And there's a certain, you know, well, I often just encourage people to really explore this, not to adopt a belief about it, but to really explore it, like just watch how choices and decisions happen. Even the simplest ones, like what are you going to say next? Or, you know, are you going to move your hand? Or you've been sitting down for a while and suddenly you want to stand up. You know, just watch as all these things happen and you start, or just as you're speaking, just pay attention to where, you know, where are these words coming from? And you start to notice, I don't know where they're coming from. They're just coming out of, they're just coming out, you know. I'm not, there's no one really back there sort of controlling all this. And in the same way, a choice or a decision, like, should I go on this trip or not, let's say. You know, there's just back and forth thoughts. Yes, you should go because it will be a wonderful adventure. No, you shouldn't go. It's going to be too expensive. You don't have the money. Yes, you should go because you're going to have a lot of fun and it will open up new vistas for you. No, you shouldn't go because you really need to stay here so you can finish this project you're doing. And, you know, these back and forth thoughts, which pop up by themselves, there's no one really doing them when you look. They just pop up. And all of a sudden you find yourself booking an airline ticket or not. And you can't really say how that clarity happened, so-called clarity happened. It just suddenly that side of the debate won out. You can't really say how. And you moved in that direction. And then thought comes in afterwards and says, I made a decision. I decided to go on the trip. And then later it might think, oh, I made the wrong decision. I should have stayed home. Look what a mess I made of everything. And then feel bad about it. But really, going on the trip was just what was happening and all the thoughts that preceded it. And when you really look, that becomes very obvious. And at the same time, we can't like make that into some sort of, again, final package conclusion, which I see people sometimes do, because then we get really confused in a different way. Because it's like, I often use just the example of opening and closing my hand. You know, doing this is obvious. It's not confusing. But as soon as I start thinking about it, well, am I doing this through free will or through choiceless happening or something, I get confused. But I can't really say how I do this or where the urge to do it in this moment comes from. And yet, I wouldn't say I can't do it. I have to just wait for the universe to do it. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
You know, so in some relative way, there is, you know, we operate with the feeling of choice. It's that neurological sensation. You know, it's like I go to the grocery store. I don't sit around waiting for the, you know, saying, well, I just have to wait and see if the universe moves me. I mean, although that's actually what's happening, but, you know, so not to sort of fixate on a conceptual picture, but when we look for the chooser or the doer, or the author of all this, we can't really find it. So practices, and I kind of avoid the word most of the time because it kind of seems to suggest something. It kind of feeds into that picture of, you know, me trying to do the right thing, maybe trying to get somewhere, trying to perfect my game, something like that. Maybe to look at it just as exploration or play or discovery or something like that. But and I feel like, as far as I'm concerned, everybody needs to find their own light, you know, and we all need different things. And we need different things at different times. And I have nothing against practices of any kind. Well, I should probably not say that. I'm not a fan of animal sacrifice. But I mean, you know, if somebody's drawn to formal meditation and, you know, counting the breath and labeling their thoughts, I mean, fine. I mean, I'm not going to say don't do that. I'm not drawn to that. You know, I'm drawn to a more, I would say, open, spacious, relaxed, informal exploration and enjoyment of what is. That sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes I sit on a meditation cushion for a while in a sort of meditation position, and I find that kind of interesting to see how that feels in the body and what that does. But most of the time I'm just sitting in my armchair or whatever, or I'm on the bus or I'm driving my car or whatever, or I'm sitting in a waiting room waiting for the doctor or the dentist or whatever, and just being there and just enjoying what's there, you know, and not needing it to be any particular way. Like if what's there is a feeling of heaviness and depression and darkness, then, you know, just to be interested in that, like, well, this is interesting. What is it? You know, because if what happens is we tend to label it. Oh, this is depression. This is bad. This is scary. This is not good. This is not enlightened. Let's get rid of this. Oh, what can I do to get rid of it? Instead of just, if I go into it, really go into it, and I don't mean go into the story and get lost in the story. I mean go into the actual sensations, the energy of it, just the bare, raw, pure feeling of it. What is it? Then it becomes interesting. Same with physical pain. You know, when it's like, oh God, I can't take this, resisting it, it gets worse. When I can just completely go into it, like this is interesting, the sensations themselves, what does this feel like? Suddenly, it's different. It's bearable and it's interesting. And same with emotional pain. It's like, and again, I'm not proposing this as like, okay, this is what we should now do all the time. I should not watch a movie if I'm feeling sad. I should sit there and feel into the sensations, because then it just becomes another, you know, thing that I have to do to be right and get somewhere. But if it interests me, maybe, just to be there and feel into it. Just to explore that. And, you know, to see the thoughts for what they are, just to see a thought like I've ruined my whole life and just notice that, oh, this is a thought. It's just a thought. It's not true. It doesn't mean anything. Because then it's not believed. It's not, it doesn't hook in the same way.
And it's not my thought. It's just,
yeah, it's just everything is impersonal. I mean, I think that's a huge realization, because we take everything personally. You know, this is my anger. This is my thought. This is my problem. This is my enlightenment. This is my success, my failure. Instead of just, this is the weather. This is the impersonal weather of the moment. This thought is just an impersonal thought, or an impersonal mood, or an impersonal sensation that's passing through like a cloud. And instead of, you know, taking it on as my problem that I have to fix so that I can finally be okay.
So, Joan, you have, you have, one-on-one meetings with folks, on Skype, a little bit like what we're doing right now. I can't recall, do you do in-person meetings?
I do. You know, I'm in a little town in Southern Oregon, so, you know, I don't get a lot of those here, but I do them if people are in Ashland and they want to have an in-person meeting. But most of the meetings I do are by phone or by Skype.
Okay. And I want to be sure and tell folks how to get a hold of you. So we can do this now, but I actually have a question about your meetings, but it's, www.joantollefson.com, right?
Right. That's my website. And I have a Facebook author page where I put articles a lot, and you can get to that from my website.
Yeah. And you have an email list? I have
an email mailing list, yeah, that you can, again, on my website, sign up for.
Okay, wonderful. Now, what I want to know is, so what leads people to say, hey, Joan, I really need to have a meeting with you? Is it because they perceive that they have a problem and that you will be able to direct them out of this situation that seems to be a problem to them?
Well, you know, I think people come for many different reasons. So I can't sum up, but I can only look at my own experience with going to various teachers and so on, you know, and what, and I, first of all, it seems different in different moments, you know, what's moving me to contact somebody. And I noticed that, again, it's a happening of life when it happens. So any sort of explanation I put on it after the fact is always just partial. It's just sort of partial. You know, it's like I've made up a story like, oh, I did this because I felt like I had a problem, or I did this because, you know, 10 people told me this person was really great and I couldn't resist, or I did this because I read your book and it was so great I had to talk to you, or whatever. It's a story, and really it's just a happening. The universe is moving that way, you know. And like, you know, what brought you to contact me for one of these interviews? You know, it's like you can make up a story of, you know, how you stumbled upon me and how, you know, your reaction and how you, you know, et cetera. But it's just a happening. You know, we can't really explain how we end up in certain places at certain times. And so, you know, but I think it's an interesting thing for each of us to look at, to pay attention to, you know, what is moving us to to go to an event or contact a teacher or pick out a book or turn on YouTube or something. Again, not as some heavy-handed thing, and certainly not as we shouldn't do this, but just, you know, we can begin to notice what's moving us, you know.
Yeah, it. I do. I hear you. It. It's funny because we, you know, it's a paradigm shift. I know it is, but it's like, you know, the reason that I want to talk to someone in your position, seemingly, the reason is so you can tell me what you did and why you feel better than you used to feel, or you can tell me what you did and why you seem to be experiencing some awake state instead of, you know, the I am bad, I've messed that up, you know. So you can tell me how you got from here to there. And by the way, I have not, I'm looking at the clock, I have not yet asked you for your story, your history, and I would like to get a little bit of that. Usually I start there, but the universe didn't move that way this time. but so it kind of puts us, again, it's got to be a... you know, my starting point, my point of view, but it kind of puts us in a tough spot when, for example, I tell the Awakening Together members, you should listen to this interview with Joan Tollefson and Jacqueline Eckert because, you know, I don't have a because. It's not like, it will change your life, or you will feel so much more peaceful, or...
Yeah, well, I don't make those kind of promises. There are some teachers that do, and I find it really kind of bullshit, to be honest. Like, if you come to my event, you're going to be happier and more peaceful and more awake. And I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to anybody if they come to my event or if they read my book. You know, some people write me and say it changed their whole life. It was great. They feel so much better. Other people, you know, oh, I didn't like that book at all. And, you know, usually the ones I hear from are the ones who liked it. But you know, some people, they read three lines and it's like, it doesn't speak to me at all. You know, it's like, this happens, you know, so I don't know what's going to happen to anybody if they, and I think that there's a whole mythology sort of about awakened people being in some, you know, and if you know these people personally, and I do know many of them personally, and I've lived with some of my teachers, you know that they're human, you know, and... Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's sort of a, you can say some people are more caught up in their stuff than other people, or some people have more suffering and confusion than other people or something. You can make those kind of relative distinctions, but there's nobody who's just, you know, utterly beyond it all as far as I'm concerned. And even the most neurotic, messed up person is still just impersonal weather. It's still, they're still... They still have a knowingness of being here now, although they may not be able to formulate it, but they still have a knowingness of being here now and a present and this present experiencing. And even in the most neurotic person, there's probably moments where there's just the experiencing of the moment with no craziness or something. And what we deem to be crazy and neurotic, again, is from our perspective. And who can say? So... You know, and there's teachers who have done all kinds of outrageously horrible things, you know, molesting their students and you know, going after the, you know, going after them, sending hitmen out after their wayward devotees. And you know, there's some really awful stories out there about what these great gurus have done. Some of them doesn't mean they didn't also have a wonderful teaching or some real realization, but they're, you know, it's like none of us is perfect in that way. There's no such thing. So they're human. We're all human. So, and my story, you know, really shows that because, you know, I did not have any sort of big awakening like Eckhart Tolle where I could say on February 3rd, 1984, you know, I was really depressed and then all of a sudden the clouds parted and ever since I've been at peace and happy and full of bliss. Nothing like that happened in my life. I've certainly had some quote peak moments and some experiences but they were just experiences. I mean, that's what I noticed, that, you know, I took acid a lot of times. I had a lot of experiences. I was a drunk for many, you know, several years, and I had some outrageous experiences. I've gone on meditation retreats and had sort of spiritual experiences. But they don't, they're just experiences, you know, and people make something out of them, like, oh, you know, I've had lucid dreams for the last 3 months and blah, blah, blah. You know, so what? that's interesting, but so what? You know, it's sort of like, and I'm just, you know, I mean, my life has changed, but everybody's life has changed. Nobody's the same as they were 20 years ago or 10 minutes ago. We're changing all the time. So it's like, how much of that was because of, quote, spiritual work, and how much of that was because I went to therapy for a while? How much of that was, you know, the fact that I was a drunk, I learned a lot from that. I really did, you know. It's like, I don't know, you know, it feels like everything is always changing, and I can still feel depressed or sad or get angry or be irritated or feel defensive or get pissed off about something. I mean, those things still happen. And if anything is different, it's that I'm not worried about them anymore. I'm not like really, well, I don't know. Even occasionally I can get really like I got really, really, really upset about something a few years ago, and I just couldn't see, it just wouldn't let go, you know, and I was kind of, you know, I guess you could say I was kind of worried about it, but I wasn't worried about being worried in a way. I mean, it's just sort of like, it's all happening, you know, like I had a finger biting compulsion since childhood, and which still flares up sometimes. And I've learned a lot from it. So I'm actually grateful for it. And, you know, there used to be a lot of shame about it. Now it just feels like it's a happening of nature when it happens. I'm not like desperately trying to stop it, and I'm just kind of interested in it or not interested in it or whatever. And it doesn't happen very often anymore. I went away for a long time and I actually thought it was gone, but it seems like it does occasionally still happen. And I don't care, you know, it's sort of like, I don't care if I'm doing it on my deathbed. It's just kind of like, so I think if anything has changed, it's that the problems don't seem like problems in the same way. It's not that I got rid of all the problems. It's just sort of that I'm not viewing them as problems in the same way. But even saying that, it's like too much, because it's like, you know, yeah, maybe I do have moments of thinking something's a problem, you know, or something. It's like, I just think we're all human. I like the title of your group, Awakening Together, because I feel like we are one whole happening, waking up together. And I think the whole phenomenon of sort of singling out special people and thinking, oh, this is, you know, wow, you know, you are in some state completely different from the one I'm in. Wow, you know, and actually we're not, you know, I mean, it's like everybody is aware, awake, present in this moment. In experiencing, I mean, this is the natural state that everybody has fundamentally. It's not some, you know, and yeah, some people have more or less stormy weather, and some people have more confusion, and some people maybe have more clarity and more ability to rest as just open presence without getting all caught up in the mind. And so it's, you know, I'm not saying that everybody is exactly the same and we shouldn't have teachers at all because there's no differences. I'm not saying that, but I think I would like to see us not mythologize teachers in the same way and not put them up on pedestals. But that happens too. And maybe it serves a purpose. I mean, sometimes devotional kind of relationship or putting someone on a pedestal, maybe that's important sometimes. I don't know. So, but certainly I don't approach it that way. I mean, I feel like I don't promise anything, and I'm not, what I'm doing isn't about results. It's really about noticing what's already here, noticing whatever's happening, and not taking it personally, not making it into my success or my failure. But just the weather of the moment. just the simplicity of this, what is, and we're not really, you know, we're one happening, really. I mean, we can distinguish between us, but we're all part of one whole happening, you could say.
Well, it's funny because the starting position makes some of my questions difficult to ask. So the question that I have is, you know, what, and you may not be able to answer it, but my question is, what motivates you to teach? I mean, why are you here with me now instead of at the mall shopping?
I don't know.
I knew you were going to say something like that.
I know, I really don't. I mean, it's like I could make up a story, but the truth is I don't know why I'm doing this. It just seems to be what my life has ended up doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't, like, you know, when I was 3 years old, I didn't decide, well, I think I'll do this. You know, it's just sort of like it's what's happened. And I don't know if I'll be doing it next year or 10 years from now, if I'm still alive then. I don't know. I just know, you know, I'm here with you now. And when I got the invitation from you, the response that came up was yes. You know, there's other things that someone asks me, you know, to come somewhere or do something, and the response that comes up is no. And I turn things down sometimes, you know. So I can't say why. I say, it's like I give money to one homeless person and not to another. I can't say why. It's just, you know, or I turn down this street sometimes and this street the other time. I don't know why. And so I can make up a story about, you know, well, I'm motivated to, you know, relieve suffering and that has some truth in it. I mean, if someone's talking to me and they're all confused and suffering, and there's maybe a natural urge to see if I can help clarify things or, but that's all sort of an overlay and it just gets in the way, because if I think I'm doing something like that, if I think I'm helping you to awaken, ugh.
I see that. I mean, that's just immediate wrong turn.
Yeah.
Wrong turn. Yeah. Because I think there's an I think there's a you, I think that something needs to be different. I mean, just the conceptualization immediately just knocks it out of whack, right?
Yeah. Right. I'm buying into your story of deficiency. I'm, you know, assuming that I have some power to do something about that deficiency that doesn't even exist. And, you know, it's just, ugh.
That's a pretty good word. Pretty good description. one of the videos that I watched in preparation for our time together today was the video of you interviewing your teacher, Tony Packer.
Oh, I have.
Yeah, that was great.
Many years ago.
And there seems to have been a movement from Joan the seeker to Joan the non-seeker, at which you have to assume for a moment there's a Joan at all. But so I'm just wondering about how this transition occurred, whether you got an Eckhart Tolle, oh, stop seeking, you know, one of those moments, or whether it just was seem like to something that fell away, or I know I'm asking you to conceptualize what has occurred in your life, but
maybe, well, seeking in some way can still happen too. I mean, you know, seeking is just sort of something it's one of those habits of humanity that we seem to have, you know, that we're like, I'm seeking something. One of my teachers, Charlotte Joko Beck, a Zen teacher, you know, she said that in a talk once. No matter what I say, she said it, you know, 10 minutes from now, we're all going to be out there seeking something. You know, it's sort of like whether it's chocolate or so I'm not seeking enlightenment anymore. I'm not seeking, you know, certain forms of seeking may fall away. And for me, again, nothing fell away in a dramatic way, but I did go through a long period where I was really seeking some sort of final enlightenment, finish line event. And I kept comparing my experience to these supposedly enlightened teachers. And it would seem like a lot of them were saying that they never identified anymore as a person, or they never got upset anymore, or this or that never happened to them anymore. And every time I would hear that, I would think, well, that's not true for me, because that still happens for me. So therefore, I haven't crossed the finish line yet that they've crossed. Or they would describe some very dramatic happening that happened on February 3rd or something, and where everything turned around completely. And I hadn't had that kind of event. So I kept seeking that for a long time and comparing myself to these other people and, you know, sort of like measuring my experience against theirs and looking for that. And then finally, it just got clearer and clearer and clearer that that was all about me. It was all about this little illusory me who felt deficient trying to get somewhere in the future. It was the problem. I mean, it was the problem that I was trying to see, I was trying to solve. You know, I just saw that more and more clearly. Again, not in one big dramatic flash. It was just seen through again and again and again, ever more clearly, that this is all about me, and it doesn't really make any sense. It's just perpetuating the fundamental illusion. You know, it's just, that's what it is. It's just a story that I have to get to the finish line, and I'm not there yet. And then eventually I just sort of noticed it's not happening anymore. And I had the same experience with, I used to think about the future all the time. And then when I went on an all-day sitting at the San Francisco Zen Center the first time, I noticed that habit for the first time. I noticed that every thought was about the future. It was like I was thinking about where I was going to park the car tomorrow and where I was going to go on my next all-day sitting, and everything was about the future. And it didn't end in that moment, but from that moment on, the lights were turned on, and every time I'd be thinking about the future, I'd notice it. And I'd notice that it was actually a form of suffering, that it was like an addiction, that there was something alluring about it, but that it was actually painful. And I just kept noticing that, seeing that. And eventually, you know, I noticed that I wasn't doing that anymore. Not that I never think about it. You know, I just wasn't habitually, obsessively doing that anymore. Again, it didn't fall away in any dramatic way. It just kind of was seen through more and more. So the same with sort of seeking enlightenment just stopped happening. And comparing myself to Nisargadatta and Rupert and Eckhart and feeling like, oh, they're so much better than I am or something, it just stopped happening. Not by picking up the opposite thought that, oh, I'm just as good as they are, or I'm actually better than they are, but just sort of that the whole thing just stopped making sense in some way. It just seemed ridiculous, irrelevant. Yeah.
I want to ask you what it is you think that we haven't talked about. We've got, like 7 minutes. Is there anything you think that we've left? I'm sure there's tons we've left out, but I just want to open the floor to you.
Nothing's coming up. Seems like we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, it's been such fun, too.
I mean, yeah, I've enjoyed it. Yeah.
So how's the book coming?
The one on
death and
old age, aging and dying and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's slowly, I've been working on it for a really long time. And the problem is that I have, see, my problem is that it's words just gush out and then I have to edit. And so I have like hundreds and hundreds of pages that need to be edited down to just a few hundred pages. And so I have to edit. And that's the part I don't really like that much and find hard to do. So I procrastinate then. I don't do it. So it's moving slowly, to say the least, but I am hopeful that it will that I'll finish it before we all die. but yeah, it's the third book of mine that's kind of a personal storybook. you know, my first book was very much my personal story, and my second book also had a lot of personal story in it. Not so much my, although I always talk about myself to some degree, but, you know, it wasn't really the focus of Painting the Sidewalk or Nothing to Grasp. But this book, again, has a lot of personal story. My mother's dying. And when I've been my past personal story books, I find that I can't really finish them until something happens in my life that I can't know what it is. Again, I'm hoping it's not my death, because that would be inconvenient for finishing. But every time somebody dies, it's sort of like, oh, maybe this will do it, you know, but no, not so far. But you know, recently I've had cancer, so that sort of, you know, seemed like it kind of fit in. And maybe that will do it. You know, we'll see, because now that's in the book. And but...
You're in remission now.
Nope. I finished the radiation and the chemotherapy, and they're going to do some tests on me in May and June that will, you know, where they'll figure out if I'm cancer free or if I still have it. And so I'm hoping that I am cancer free.
Yes. Me too.
But it's actually been a really positive experience, even though it was painful at times. But, you know, I really, found it very transformative. And
just in the moment, Joan. This has, as I said, this has been a lot of fun, and I have felt very present while present with you.
I've really enjoyed being with you and talking with you. It's been great. Yeah.
And we'll tell our listeners once again that to contact you, they should go to www.joantolifson.com.
You tell me. This is a routine. See, I can't tell you how many hours of my life I spend spelling my name, because people just can't. My mother said, next life I'm coming back as a Smith. anyway, so it's T as in Tom, O-L-L, I, F as in Frank, S as in Sarah, O, N as in Nancy. Tall, if, son.
JoanTolifson.com. All right. And you said you had a Facebook.
Oh, for I have.
I'll do it this time.
It's kind of fun. The phone is kind of fun, actually. it's participating. It wants to participate. I have a personal Facebook page and a Facebook author page, but my author page is where I post articles and stuff like that, so... And there's a link to that on my website, so people can find that through my website or probably just by Googling me.
And your books are available on your website?
You can find more about them on my website, and they're all available through Amazon and the publisher, which the first book was published by Random House, Bell Tower. Now it's published by Three Rivers, which is the digital division of Random House. And the other three books were published by Non-Duality Press in the UK, which was has now been bought as an imprint of New Harbinger. So they're now published by New Harbinger. And that's all on the website, how to find them through Amazon or through the publisher.
Okay, and thank you again. I am going to stop the recording, but don't go away.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah.